Do we need to treat these kids as if they've got adductal-dependent lesions?
Welcome to Peds Grit. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow from UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow at Children's National in Washington, D.C.
Alice, will you remind us what we do here at Peds Grit?
Absolutely. Peds Grit is an educational PICU podcast. We're looking for the best bedside teaching around the country and the world, and we are putting them in your favorite podcast app. Today, we're doing part one of the congenital diaphragmatic hernia series. In this episode, we're talking about the basic anatomy and physiology of CDH, as well as that really important prenatal risk assessment. Zach, who did you recruit to talk about this?
Today, we have two expert guests for us. We have Dr. Amir Ashrafi and Dr. Yeet Gunner. Starting with Dr. Gunner, he's an assistant professor of surgery at UC Irvine, where he's a pediatric surgeon at the Children's Hospital of Orange County. He completed his pediatric surgery fellowship at UT Houston, and he completed a postdoc fellowship at CHLA. He is nationally recognized for his work in CDH, and we are so thankful to have him here today.
Yes, and Dr. Amir Ashrafi is a dual-boarded neonatal cardiologist at the Children's Hospital of Orange County. He did his NICU fellowship at UCLA and his cardiology fellowship at Boston Children's. He's interested in perfusion monitoring and outcomes in infants with congenital heart disease, and he is also the co-founder of the NeoHeart Conference, which tackles these issues in depth.
Yes, this is a great part one to this series episode. Let's get right into the content. Welcome to the podcast. We are so excited to be joined by two special guests today. First, a neonatologist, Dr. Amir Ashrafi, and pediatric surgeon, Dr. Yeet Gunner. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
To get things started, will each of you share something about yourself and include something you enjoy outside of medicine?
I enjoy my two kids, and I enjoy my bicycles. I'm an avid cyclist.
Oh, nice. Road or mountain?
And these days, just about everything to break the monotony.
Very fair.
Dr. Trashby, go ahead.
Also, two girls take up most of my time, and when I'm not with those two, I enjoy chasing any sort of round ball. If it's a soccer ball, if it's a basketball, if it's I don't even like pickleball, but if it's a pickleball, if it's a round ball, I don't know, maybe I've got some canine in me. I just love that. That's what I do when I'm not working.
That's so great. I see a theme of it, getting outside and enjoying the Southern California weather for sure.
Exactly right.
I'd like to know how each of you became interested in congenital diaphragmatic hernia and how this relates to your current professional interests and research interests.
When you look at neonatology, there's a huge spectrum of neonatology. It can range everywhere from feeders and growers in community hospitals to, you know, really sick babies in academic centers. And my interests tend to fall on that side, particularly those with congenital heart disease, those with pulmonary hypertension. And I would say that pulmonary hypertension in general is something that I really do enjoy. What makes diaphragmatic hernia so interesting is that it's not such a straightforward case of PH, and that's actually the part of it I enjoy the most. These kids will have a combination of hypoxic vasoconstriction, vascular hypoplasia, muscular hypertrophy. Then you add a component to LV hypoplasia and pulmonary venous hypertension. And so managing all those multiple physiologies that encompasses PH is what I find so interesting and so challenging, and it's not a one-size-fits-all. But then not only that, then you type a look at the personalities who are also interested in this, and they tend to be people similar to myself. You got Dr. Gunner over here. We have our mentor, Dr. Cleary, just very engaging, very dynamic, very back and forth. What about this? What about that? And it's just that back and forth is probably the funnest part of managing these complex kids, particularly the extreme CDH.
Oh. Well, we have a lot of respect for the way that you've embraced the complexity of these patients, and I'm sure that they benefit from the team approach. Dr. Gunner, what about you?
For me, it was more of an accident in kind of self-discovery of self-interests, but when I was a research fellow at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, the pediatric surgery fellow was Dr. Faisal Qureshi, who's now in Dallas, but he said, hey, do you want to do this project on ELSO looking at VA versus VV ECMO comparison? I said, sure, I'll do it. And that was it. I was hooked. And I just kept doing the same thing over and over and over again.
That's great. I didn't realize the connection with Dr. Qureshi here in Dallas. That's very fun. It's a small world.
Yes, it's a small world.
Do you have any recommendations for perhaps critical care or surgical trainees who might want to become more involved in this area? Think about conferences to attend, resources, people to know, things of that nature.
So it's actually an interesting question. Part of it, I think, can be challenging depending on how your unit is set up. So for example, in our unit, these kids just invariably come to the NICU right away. So if a PICU fellow wants to be interested, there's no easy mechanism to get PICU fellows involved other than having that face-to-face connection, finding who the people down, and for us, it's downstairs. Say, next time one of these patients comes, let me know. We have an attending, Juliet Hunt. She's a PICU attending. She's made it very clear this is something she really finds interesting. So every once in a while, we'll give her a call and say, hey, here's this kid who's, you know, complex CDH. What do you think about this? But in general, it's sort of hard to, at least the way our hospital is set up, to get them directly involved. However, with regards to conferences, more and more people are starting to, you know, the World Congress, which is coming up, we're going to have an entire session dedicated to the hemodynamics of diaphragmatic hernia. We host a meeting every year called NeoHeart, where diaphragmatic hernia is always featured. There's actually an online event coming soon dedicated to congenital diaphragmatic hernia. As the world gets smaller and smaller with new media, new education, I do think there's multiple opportunities. But with regards to face-to-face bedside care, it does require somebody to go above and beyond based on how the infrastructure of their hospital is.
Yeah. For surgical residents, there's one good resource which got a Pali from Michigan started. It is a monthly Wednesday afternoon conference that rotates between different hospitals that anyone can listen in.
Oh, that's awesome.
If you'd be interested in sharing that information with us, we'd be happy to.
Sure.
We ask everyone who comes on the pod, do you two have any relevant conflicts of interest to disclose before we get started with the interview?
No, but once him and I had an argument, severe argument, about the use of Amicar when we first met. And that kind of started our friendship.
That's exactly right.
It's maybe a trigger to avoid.
Or lean into.
Ago now.
That's right. We were actually, we were in orientation together at Chalk. He had just come from Texas. I just come from Boston. And we're like, hey, I like this guy and he likes me. And then, yeah, our first patient, we got into it over Amicar. I remember this.
That's so great. We'll have to lean in on the anticoagulation management and periop in these patients and see what comes out.
Okay.
Alice, you want to give us our case and we'll jump into the topic?
Absolutely. A pregnant woman at 39 weeks gestation is admitted prior to her scheduled repeat C-section. Her baby was prenatally diagnosed with a congenital diaphragmatic hernia detected at the 20-week ultrasound. She's been following closely with maternal fetal medicine, and the CDH team has recommended delivery today. So before we dive into this topic, what exactly is a congenital diaphragmatic hernia? What do we want to know about this woman's baby before she delivers?
That's an interesting set of questions. The near-term baby who needs to be delivered perhaps is outside the CDH dilemma and perhaps has to do with the fetal viability or fetal stress test that's happening that's irrelevant of the diaphragmatic hernia, I would say.
Oh, so you wouldn't...
I don't see an indication for having a diaphragmatic hernia that why you would have to have a C-section or delivery right at 39 weeks. And there has to be something happening to the fetus that would, for me, lead to that recommendation.
Certainly. So if we were to refocus our case and say, this mother is carried fully to term, it's time for her to be delivered, maybe we'll start with the basics of congenital diaphragmatic hernia. Dr. Gunner, will you just tell us what we need to know about the anatomic considerations before then we'll transition to Dr. Ashrafi and talk about the physiologic conditions associated with the syndrome.
So the most important thing I guess we could find out from the initial screening is whether a baby has diaphragmatic hernia. Check. Once we know that, they can tell us other information such as, is it on the right side or the left side? 80% are left-sided, which is a posterolateral defect, also known as the Bactalex hernia. You can also have a right-sided hernia, which is less common. You can also have about 3% of the patients have a bilateral severe defect. Those are the anatomic versions. And let's focus back on the left-sided hernia. And the ways we know how severe it is, although you know this postnatally when you do surgery, how big the diaphragmatic defect is, small, medium, large, extra large. Prenatally, you don't know that. But if a significant chunk of the liver is in the chest, that indicates perhaps it's a very large defect. On the right side, obviously, the liver is in the chest, so those measurements are very different.
Certainly. And Dr. Ashrafi, to bring you in here, having that diaphragmatic hernia certainly negatively influences the development of the cardiopulmonary system. If you'd like to get into some of the physiologic consequences of CDH, that'd be great.
Sure. I think where everybody jumps right to is obviously the impact that it does have on lung development. I think that's pretty obvious. You've got essentially a mass occupying lesion in the thorax. There's only so much space. So you're going to have significant pulmonary hypoplasia. And of course, just, you know, side by side, hand in hand, as you've got pulmonary parenchymal hypoplasia, you're going to have pulmonary vascular implications of that as well. And I think that's where most people spend a lot of their time. However, in the last maybe 5 to 10 years or so, there's been quite a bit of resurgence in asking the question about the hemodynamic burden of a diaphragmatic hernia beyond just the gas exchange burden that takes place. And for the longest time, you know, when I was a fellow, it was always right heart failure, implications of the right heart and pulmonary hypertension. But more and more, we're starting to realize that it's actually the left heart that is just as affected, if not more so affected, in the setting of diaphragmatic hernia, particularly severe diaphragmatic hernia. So the more interesting question that's coming up lately is, in the severe CDH, do we need to treat these kids as if they've got ductal-dependent lesions because of the impact it does have on the left side? So that's where the current argument is with regards to the hemodynamic impact of diaphragmatic hernia. And again, particularly severe diaphragmatic hernia. For mild, this doesn't really apply.
And the way I've kind of started thinking of this dilemma that Amir is mentioning is, and maybe we've all thinking about this together last decade, but the severe defects with a severely dilated right heart sometimes leads to sort of hypoplast left heart type situation. Don't you think, Amir?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what I'm envisioning is, as a trainee, you correct me if I feel like I don't have it correctly, you have this hypoplastic lung, you have high pulmonary vascular resistance, maybe the septum potentially be bowed into the left ventricle, maybe you have lots of intestines in the thorax, maybe that compresses the left ventricle as well, and that may reduce flow and therefore development of that left ventricle. Is that a fair way to rationalize this?
You nailed it exactly right. First study came out, if I remember, it was in the mid-80s or so, if I'm not mistaken. Throughout 9 months gestation, the amount of pulmonary blood flow varies over time. But if you average it all out, approximately 7 to 10% of your flow actually goes to the lungs. The other 90 some odd percent gets shunted through the ductus arteriosus down the descending ileum to the placenta. So there's about 7 to 10% when you average it all. That 7 to 10% comes back to the left atrium, comes to the left ventricle. And so you get this volume loading that takes place. And again, we've known from hypoplastic left heart data that it's volume loading that leads to LV growth, not pressure loading per se during gestation. And so in the patients with severe diaphragmatic hernia, where you get severe vascular hypoplasia, you get more right to left shunting through the ductus throughout gestation. Because you get more shunting right to left, you get less pulmonary blood flow, you get less pulmonary venous return. You've now got reduced preload to that left side throughout 9 months. Now they've got this smaller, stiff, non-compliant left ventricle. So when you start taking things that Dr. Gunnar was talking about, like the heart-heart interactions, you add on top of that small, stiff, non-compliant LV, then we have to start taking that into consideration as well.
That's a great explanation. And it certainly makes this disease process fascinating because of all of the intricate cardiopulmonary interactions and even left heart and right heart. Something that you mentioned earlier and gave us a hint into is some of the prenatal workup. And I imagine there's probably some variability site to site, but maybe speaking for your institution or what's most common, what type of prenatal evaluation do these mothers receive prior to delivery?
So most get their anatomy scan as the case description around 20 weeks, and the discovery is made, then they're referred to a perinatologist. At that time, most get a perinatologist ultrasound, and the information I indicated earlier is obviously you get side of the defect, understand where the liver is relative to the diaphragm, but there are also indices like the lung head ratio, also known as LHR. That was first described in the early 2000s, I believe, at UCSF. At that time, they just thought of it as LHR. But they realized later that as the baby grows, the head and the lungs grow at different rates. So that was Dr. Roman Sidorak's paper that led to that ratio being developed. But over time, they said, let's look at an observed to expected ratio. Because at 30 weeks, the ratio changes. So you can get a falsely elevated or falsely reassuring number. And so the observed to expected gives you a better understanding. So less than 25%, that would indicate high risk. At some point came MRI. And there are two measurements that I know that exist, but the most common one used is total fetal lung volume. Again, that's that convert to observed to expected. They can also give you a similar less than 25% to high risk category. And as you know, the total trial used observed to expected lung to head ratio. And I'm not sure if that's more reproducible or easier to replicate elsewhere. And there are multiple different ways of measuring LHR and converting it to observed to expected. And I used to go on the total trial website to do that myself. But the paleontologists are more familiar with those calculations. So that brings the biases that go in it, the measurement bias that comes with the person measuring it, the reading bias that comes with the person reading it, converting it. So I have been tracking our own ratios at our center. So at what OTE do we need to go on ECMO? Because like everybody looks up these papers and says, well, Texas Children's, between this and this ratio, the because no one can tell you how, like when moms pregnant come to the office and they're like, well, is my baby going to need ECMO? There's no way to tell them. Mm-hmm. Your baby is either high risk, moderate risk, or low risk. Perhaps if you track your own numbers and know your own ECMO utilization rate, because some centers are more liberal and the other centers are less liberal in ECMO utilization, which isn't right or wrong, but that's a separate discussion. Mm-hmm. So that would be my answer to that. Track your own numbers and know, you know, in your own hands, what babies usually end up going on ECMO, assuming there's no iatrogenic other issues that lead to ECMO. Nice.
So it sounds like, first of all, it sounds like a really incredible thing that you're doing for your patients, tracking your own numbers and saying, here, this is what we do for babies like yours. That sounds like a gift. When these families are getting this information, it sounds like you are stratifying these neonates into a risk category. What kind of information about even predicting whether or not the baby is going to survive can you give the families?
It's hard because I think you do have to have a little bit of equipoise and also some humility. The numbers are numbers, and sometimes babies don't behave. You could have a moderate risk baby who acts like a high risk baby. That does happen. And then you have a high-risk baby that sometimes act like a moderate-risk baby. So perhaps all you can say is that your baby is most likely going to require prolonged mechanical ventilation. You can say that.
Yes.
But I don't know that I can say your baby's going to survive. That's a harder thing to say to them, at least yes. My perspective. Others have different perspectives and perhaps more confidence in their own numbers and what they mean. Mm-hmm. I tend to be more open-ended with that.
Yeah.
Maybe another question for us, because we're not a center that offers tracheal occlusion, is when do you refer a patient for that? And sometimes that's a very difficult discussion. And some families come, you know, prepared to ask for that. Others have not, they don't even know that it exists. So it's an interesting discussion. Mm-hmm. And centers don't always accept them, even if they qualify, based on many reasons.
And we'll certainly come back to tracheal occlusion. It's a question I wanted to bring up. Dr. Gunner, you mentioned the observed to expected lung head ratio and total fetal lung volume are certainly really helpful. Is liver position helpful for you at all in risk stratifying these kids?
Yes. For example, a moderate risk baby on, you know, moderate measurements, but liver up in the chest, that might actually be a high risk baby.
Yes.
At least in my hands, I've found that anecdotally to be the case, but obviously studies have looked at percent of liver in the chest and there are measurements or ways to use that, but I am not tracking our own numbers, and we're not actually measuring, I don't think, percent of liver in the chest.
Yes.
There are a few other things. For example, sometimes the stomach could be all the way across to the right side on a left hernia. Others have looked at other cardiac indices. Maybe Amir knows them better. But typically, the observed to expected LHR is my go-to. And I know based on what we do, I trust our perinatologists have very accurate measurements, and I find that to be very helpful. MRI is also helpful, gives you a more visual ability to look at things. But I do like LHR better.
Yes.
So liver position up, down, you know, there's been a lot of studies that say their outcomes are worse. There's the obvious, the bigger the defect, liver's going to be up, and there's the implications of a bigger defect. What's interesting, secondarily, is that when your liver is up, it changes the position of your ductus venosus. So why is that important? Blood comes from the placenta, highly oxygenated through the ductus venosus, gets shunted directly across the PFO into the left heart. And again, we talked about volume loading of the left heart, which allows for LV growth. When your liver is up, now you've changed the three-dimensional geometry of your ductus venosus. So now it's angled towards your tricuspid valve. So if that's the case, you get blood coming back from placenta, down the tricuspid valve, RV, PA, out the ductus down to the body. Again, you've limited the preload to the left side. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about implications for ECMO, I imagine, and why these kids go on ECMO. But part of the reason is if you have a small, stiff left ventricle from just such volume underloading over 9 months gestation, that's in part why liver position becomes so problematic. You're hurting the growth of that left ventricle.
That is fascinating physiology and something that I was not aware of. And I will certainly take that from our discussion today. Dr. Ashrafi, another question. I know, at least locally, a fetal echocardiogram is part of the evaluation of these patients before they're born. And just like to know what information that you would look for on those fetal echoes to give you an idea how sick this patient might be.
Good question. Fetal echo, I guess there'd be two things I would look at. Size of left-sided structures and where the heart is in the position of the chest. If it is a left-sided lesion and the heart's all the way over, that tells you it's probably going to be more problematic. And then left-sided Z-scores.
Yeah.
Because again, that just tells you how severe the pulmonary vascular hypoplasia is.
Certainly. And another concept that is so obvious, as you didn't mention, is if there's any other concomitant cardiac defect.
Right? Absolutely.
Goes without saying. Yeah.
Goes without saying. Specifically, I want to say it's 10% of all babies with congenital diaphragmatic hernia also have heart disease. The most common of which are left-sided outflow tract obstructive lesions like coarctation, like mitral valve, aortic valve stenosis, for some of the reasons we just discussed.
Yes. I'd like us to circle back to the tracheal occlusion. And just for the listeners, some patients maybe who have severe CDH might be a candidate for what's so-called a fetal endoluminal tracheal occlusion. It's either Dr. Ashrafi or Dr. Gunner. What exactly is that? And then is there any consensus on which patients might be most appropriate for that procedure?
So this idea evolved from Dr. Harrison and eventually has had a number of trials, most recently the TOTAL trial. It's inflating a balloon in the fetal trachea and leading that to create a post-obstructive growth of the lung parenchyma and hoping that then overcomes the anatomic collapse of the lung from the hernia as a reverse of that situation. And so we can talk about my understanding of a TOTAL trial or what I think of it, but it's an interesting concept. We are not a center at the moment that does that, and I'm not sure that if everyone should be. That's also a separate discussion, but I'll leave it with that simple explanation.
Certainly.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, this is, as a novice, as someone who works on the PICU side, this is a fetal procedure where you inflate the lung in hopes that it will develop more fully.
Or you occlude the trachea.
You will occlude the trachea and keep it inflated.
You basically insert the balloon into the fetal trachea, which is then later removed, I believe, either 2 weeks or some a short subsequent time after that. And that leads to a post-obstructive growth of the lung.
Certainly.
The fetal lung is constantly making fluid that during most of gestation slowly comes out from the alveoli up through the trachea and out and then gets swallowed down. So part of it is if you put a balloon in, that fluid that is being made cannot come up and is forced to stay down. That gives back pressure and allows alveolar growth to take place.
Wow.
So fascinating. In my very novice understanding of literature is that it's unclear exactly which patients will benefit from this. And the time will tell, right, as we get more information.
The studies are interesting. And like most fetal studies, we never have a control arm.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say definitively.
Certainly.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as a replacement for medical advice. It's also worth noting that the views expressed during this episode by me, Zach, and our guests are our own and do not reflect the official position of our institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedescritpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to help support the production of Pete's Crit, you can find us on Venmo and Patreon. We've also had some light merch made in the form of Pete's Crit laptop stickers. And if you include a mailing address with any contribution, we would be so excited to send you one. Thank you again for listening.